Thank you, Mark. We are studying together Proverbs chapter 7, and we are in the temptation of the adulteress to this young man and the lesson that's being taught by the parents to the child. And our lesson begins in verse 6 and ends in verse 20 this morning. Before I read the text, I brought you a gift. I brought these books. I mentioned ISIS and the Muslim faith and Sharia law last time, and this woman has come to faith out of that. And my wife convinced her to tell her story, and so they put it in a book, and I'm making that available to you today. It's an amazing story of divine providence. How in the world she could come to America as a Muslim and then be saved, and the one church that she would visit and the pastor there, First Presbyterian Church, Edmond, Oklahoma, was a former Muslim. And he said, "We have so very much in common." So she knew instantly where she would go. So these books are available to you. Please take them. We hope that there will be a wide and broad distribution for the sake of the gospel. Proverbs chapter 7, beginning in verse 6. At the window of my house I looked out through the lattice. I saw among the simple, I noticed the young man, a youth who lacked judgment. He was going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house at twilight as the day was fading, as the dark of the night set in. Then out came a woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute with crafty intent. She was loud and defiant. Her feet never stay at home. Now she's in the street, now in the squares. At every corner she lurks. She took hold of him and kissed him, and with a brazen face she said, "I have fellowship offerings at home. Today I fulfill my vows. So I came out to meet you. I looked for you and have found you. I have covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let's drink deep of love till the morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not home. He has gone on a long journey. He took his purse filled with money and will not be home till the full moon." I want to begin our lesson of this seduction and temptation this morning by pointing out to you the conscious consideration of the power of observation. You see, that is your verb to look in verse 6. Wisdom, the skill for living, it is exemplified in your learning life and watching. Your observation, your experiences, they all become your classroom for learning. Let me just show you that from the book of Proverbs. "I went past the field of a sluggard, past the vineyard of a man who lacks judgment. Thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with weeds, and a stone wall was in ruins." Now listen to this. "I applied my heart to what I observed, and I learned a lesson from what I saw." So your experiences of life and the things you see with this skill for living will teach you, will guide you, and serve as an instruction for you. That's our starting point for our morning lesson. It's all predicated on the power of observation. What the parents have seen is now going to be transferred to the child. And that is our opening phrase this morning, at the window. Of course, houses in the ancient Near East had no glass. This word would refer to a hole in the wall, a place to let light and air into a room. And we would normally think we would skip over the word house, but the word house, you see, is going to cast a big, long shadow over this entire text. And so we note the subtle contrast of what's going on. The woman of verse 10 is, notice verse 8, out in the street, near the corner. The point is, she's not at home. And that's your contrast. The virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 is in her home. She is making clothes, settling the affairs to benefit her family, never to be idle. Now, in the typical Israelite house, archaeologists tell us that this matches the depiction. There are normally two stories. The first story is like what we would call a garage today. You put your implements for doing your work on the first floor. Remember, this is an agrarian economy. So all your tools would be there. And then you would be upstairs, and the upper floor would be the living quarters, typically two or three rooms. Verse 6, this word translated lattice is like some form of a wooden shutter, a place that they could see out, but no one could see in or be seen to looking in. And now here is the important verb for our study today. It is to look out. But you see, literally, it means to look down. It is a rich Old Testament word that we couldn't skip. It just has too much meaning for us. Genesis 26 and verse 8, where Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, and here's your verb, looked down from his window and saw Isaac caressing his wife Rebekah. It's found in 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 16, when the ark of the Lord was entering Jerusalem, and Michal, daughter of Saul, there is our verb, looked down, and she saw him dancing before the ark and before the people of the Lord. You see, study these words and you learn the Old Testament stories. They come out at you. Now, I want you to observe that we move from verse 6, the camera angle from the window down to the street, to now we put the camera on the street itself and the observation therein. And here comes the first party for us. He's called the simple, literally gullible, used 14 times in the book of Proverbs. He is easily misled. He is the simplest form or mildest form of the fool, raw, inexperienced, uncommitted, but most importantly, he is open to sin. His life simply has a screen door in the submarine. All you have to do is open the window. Whatever's outside will come rushing in. That's his life. That's this man. Thus, he becomes the mark on the street. You see, the important thing is he was never taught at home. That's why he's in this condition. And thus, that's why we have the lesson. I want you to also observe, by identifying him in verse 7 as the simple, that the parents are actually giving us a back-to-the-future insight into the story. You see, they're giving us the conclusion before the event itself. Interesting way to put the text for us and define the story. Here he is, for the moment, walking down the street, minding his own business, whistling all the way, we would say. Then verse 8, here he is, in a perfectly normal setting. There's nothing inherently wrong with the street. There's nothing deadly about the corner. But the problem is with him. You see, he's lacking judgment. And therefore, every circumstance, every situation of life can be dangerous ground because the danger is within. You know, you want to ask, where was the father for this boy? Where were the parents training up this lad? If you have failed with your children, and we all to some extent certainly have, then let's do this, or let's agree to do this. Let's go to them and tell them how I failed. I want you to forgive me. I've asked the Lord to forgive me. If judgment begins in the household of God, then let's begin with ourselves. Let's consider ourselves first. And let's ask that they forgive. Now, it doesn't matter what the reaction is. It doesn't matter if they cry, if they yell, if they're angry, if they bolt away. You don't know the amount of good that you just did. Because you see, you set a plumb line right there for their life and for your life as well. You planted a flag. You put down a stake. This is righteousness. Howard Hendricks used to tell us young students, your children will never be looking for perfect parents. They're only looking for real ones. So be real. You leave what you did with the Lord, and you let Him go to work from that point forward. My father came to faith late in his life, right here at Believer's Chapel. And he couldn't give me any guidance or instruction about the Christian life. I was farther along than he was. But the one thing that made an indelible impression upon me is I watched my father's life change. And I'll never recover from that. It was unbelievable to me. And it marks me to this day. So here he is, verse 8, this simpleton. On dangerous ground, because there's nothing wrong with the street or the corner. The danger, verse 7, is that he lacked judgment. You see, he's not looking for problems. He's not looking for complexities. He's not looking for this woman. The fact is, verse 10, she's looking for him. Now, verse 9, we here want to pay attention to the time because, you see, the text gives it to us. At twilight, at dusk, the Hebrew language is so picturesque. It's literally the time to blow. It's when the evening winds rush in consistently and repeatedly at the end of the day. That's your word. Job chapter 3, verse 9, the time that the stars come out visibly when the night sets in. One of the commentators said that every word used in verse 9 portends to darkness, both physically and spiritually, because it is now coming. And here it is in verse 10. It's an exclamation like this. Out! Look! That's the Father bringing the story and our eyes to the story. Like stepping out on center stage, the spotlight is all on her. This word dressed, a very rare word in the Old Testament. It's translated in Psalm 73 and verse 6 as clothes, used to emphasize the way a person is dressed. Here, it's provocative, something instantly recognizable. We think of Tamar, Genesis 38, when she pulled that ruse on her father-in-law, Judah. She dressed like a prostitute. So the way she was dressed indicated who she was or what she was. That's the idea. So teachers have suggested her dress is that of perhaps a priestess, a devotee of a fertility cult. That would support the claim of her offering sacrifices in verse 14 of personal vows that she had taken. Beatrice Brooks, It's always insightful to have a woman's perspective. Describes this secular and sacred strange woman this way. Arrayed in elaborate and flashing red garments, much jewelry, cosmetics. Possibly she also sang to attract attention. She would have a special mark on her forehead, and she would be consistently found on the streets, on every high hill, under every green tree, by the shrines, by the threshing floors, and by the waysides. All of her dress is for the appeal. It's look at your text, with crafty intent. You see that? Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1, that's your word. The serpent was more crafty than all of the wild animals. You remember how Potiphar's wife made Joseph look so guilty and so foolish, screaming out in her house, holding his cloak, holding it close till her husband got home at the end of the day. It was a he said, she said. But she has the rank and she has the evidence. But Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 19 is as true as the day you wrote it as it is today. Lying lips are only for the moment. Eventually, the truth comes out. And God put his hand and mark on this young boy, Joseph, and elevated him to all of Egypt. Now notice verse 11. The parents stop the story here. You see that? Now they're going to stop and give us the characteristics of this woman. There's four things that I want you to observe here. First, she's loud. The word is visual and auditory, both. Jeremiah chapter 47 and verse 3, used of rumbling wheels of a chariot. Used in 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 16, of the sound of confusion in a military camp when brought under attack. You see, her movements in the street are loud, clamorous. And she's out in the street because she's not in the home. Now, second, I want you to look, she is defiant. You see that? Back in 1975, Helen Reddy sang to us, I am woman, hear me roar. I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman. And I think back, gosh, when you consider our society, our moral standard today, who could have believed that we would call those the good old days when Helen Reddy sang to us? You remember? It was the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, Alan Alda debating George Will, getting furious, red-faced, waving his hands at Will. Those were the good old days. This word defiant is found in Hosea chapter 4 and verse 16, and it's translated as stubborn. And there in Hosea, it's stubborn as a cow. What's the point? You can't teach her anything. She's set in her ways. Third, observe her feet. See, they're never settling. That's why she's in the street. She's not by any measure the woman she makes herself out to be. Religious, practicing piety. So we see a contradiction in the way she talks to the way she acts. Fourth, verse 12. Look at another description. She's a lustful woman on the prowl. In the street, in the plaza. In other words, she's all over town. She's a with it woman. She's exciting. Has energy. She's great at meeting men. Extends that right hand, firm handshake, looks them right in the eye. Now verse 13, we're back to the narrative of the story itself. And here is her bold approach. Observe she is aggressive. now no longer talking. She grabs him, she kisses him. The brazen face means she's shameless in her aggression. We teach our children, you are never aggressive with the opposite sex. Never. But she is. And once she has him in her clutches, she begins her proposition. They come in the form of two arguments. The first, verses 14 through 17, that she needs him for religious reasons, having lavishly prepared her bedroom. The second is verse 18 through 20, and that argument simply is that there's nothing to fear. Now, let's look closely at the details. These fellowship offerings are a type of sacrifice either practiced by the Canaanites or it could be the Israelites. We're not really sure. We don't know the origin of this woman's worship by the detail that we have here. It could be a meal for Aphrodite or it could be simply Hebrew worship. 1 Samuel 9:13. Israel went to worship, but first Samuel led them in a meal. We just don't know. Notice the vows are in the plural, referring to any number of accumulated practices that would make her orthodox or acceptable. The picture here is of a very religious woman, prim and proper. So she's a hypocrite with God and a harlot with men. Verse 15, so, thus, therefore, the exact match of verse 10, I came out diligently. It's an intensive verb. Why? Just for you. You see, what makes her so dangerous is she comes on with such an air of religiosity. Charles Bridges, in his commentary on Proverbs, tells us that the famous mistress of Louis XIV was so rigid in her religious duties that during Lent she had her bread weighed on scales at the table, but not before God. So here it is. I came out to meet you. The NIV is literally your face, meaning your attractive features. She singled him out. What is really ironic is what singled him out was that he was a simpleton. That's why we have the chapter. And now with him in her clutches, here she has her prize. She declares, I found you. She clamps down to drag him off to her den. She chose him. She sought him. And now she invites him. Verse 16, so here she goes. She's an artist. You see the canvas? You see the palette and her brush? She's now going to paint for us pictures. Watch the artist go to work. Verse 16, a vision to bring him under her ether, never to be able to resist. Preparations that she's made. Watch her canvas go. Look at the verb, I have. Literally, I have provided. And this is now a very rare word that we have to go outside the Old Testament scriptures for to get it. It's a word used 1,400 years before Christ, and it simply means bedding, a pallet, a place to lie down. Very rare word. Here, the bed is repeated for emphasis, here and in verse 17. It's literally the word couch, and it's used 8 times that way in the book of Psalms. It's just a place to lie down, not a Sealy Posturepedic. They didn't have them in those days, you see. And now she's filling his mind with images. Here's one, colored linens, a soft place to lie down, another rare word. For the bed's comfort, an aesthetic appeal. From Egypt, by the way, her husband must be doing very well. Very expensive, a sign of status, the quality of the linen, the industry of dyeing, cloth. now became prominent at this time in world history. I find it interesting that this woman is doing the exact same thing as the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. I want you to see that. Proverbs 31:22, she makes coverings for her bed. That's the virtuous woman. That's what this woman is doing. They're doing the same thing, but with entirely different motives. Verse 17, to perfect the bed's preparation, she's perfumed it. Myrrh, aloes, cinnamon. You see, these spices tell us a lot about the quality of her life and the quality of life this woman enjoys. These are prized perfumes in the ancient Near East. They have to be obtained from merchants who travel great distances. 2 Kings chapter 20 and verse 12, they're included in the vast treasuries of King Hezekiah. And all of this is what her husband provided her, so that she could have life on her own terms. Here's her point. Hey, my husband's got a putting green in our backyard. You can use that. Swim in his swimming pool. Drive around in his Bentley. You can use it all. That's her argument. Now here's the second half of the seduction, verses 18 through 20. And here it's simply under one sentence. There is nothing to fear. Verse 18. Here's the invitation. Come, calling for immediate action. Don't think about it. All the preparations have been made. It's all there waiting for you. Commit. To drink deep is to be saturated. Love till morning. That needs no explanation. But interesting, this word love tells us everything. Look at it. You see it? It's only physical attraction. That's all. It's used in 2 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 1. Let me read it to you. Amnon, son of David, fell in love. That's our word right here. With Tamar, his beautiful half-sister, a sister by another marriage of David's. The scriptures tell us that he loved her. They also tell us that he used her. And they tell us that he abandoned her. It's called the hookup today. Just for the moment. No commitments, short period of time. That's all it is. No real emotional ties. It's all for the physical. And the damage that that has done to us psychologically and done to us spiritually as a nation. And now verse 19, here is why there's nothing to fear. Literally, it's the man. That's the husband. Oh, you remember him, don't you? He's the one that's paying for all this. He's gone. Oh, he's long gone. Everything I've told you is just so. So we can assume the same, can't we? And so here is her argument. I don't want you to miss it. Verse 19. Her argument is, out of sight is out of mind. Now why is that so important? Because when you go through the book of Psalms, that is the categorical argument repeated over and over and over again by the wicked. Out of sight, out of mind. God can't see. He doesn't hear. He doesn't know. It's everywhere in the book of Psalms. 10:11, He covers His face. He doesn't see. 94:7, the Lord does not see. That's what the wicked say. Out of sight, out of mind. If you can't see Him and He can't see you, why do you care? That's the force of her argument. Verse 20, here's her reinforcement. Skin, a pouch of money. Much business my husband has to translate. All for her lifestyle, that she might have life on her own terms. And all that that means. Her claim, he will not be home till the full moon, she says with certainty. Now that could be either she is marking the time by the moon, and therefore marking the days that way, or it could be travel time, because Psalm 121 tells us that under the full moon, many Bedouins traveled into the night in the cool air and made great distances. So that's when the end would be coming for his travel, the full moon. He would be getting home. I want you to think about the force of her argument, verses 19 and 20. There's nothing to fear. Nothing to fear. He's long gone. Or is he? Don Matthews, he is a good friend of mine, a captain in the Oklahoma City Police Department. Don is an elder in his church, has walked with the Lord for many years. And once in our conversations, he told me about God's grace saving him before he was ever saved. I said, tell me about that, Don. Well, he said, I graduated from high school and I was an angry black man. That's the way he described himself. But he knew he wanted an education, so he went through the military, and there he found a home. He loved it. The rank, the file, the uniforms, everything about it. The orders, the regiment. And he thrived and moved right up. So much so that after basic training, they began to fill patches on his chest and ask him actually to stay over and train young recruits. So he did. Along the way, he married a young woman who had a little girl. And his commitment and promise to his wife is, I'm going to raise that little girl and I'm going to educate her. That's my commitment in marriage. About a year, year and a half into their marriage, living on the base in one of the small government duplexes, he was sent away on a training mission, taking all of his men. They were to helicopter out, go to a similar state, stay a week, and come back. But as they assembled on the tarmac that Friday afternoon, they got a whistle and all the orders were canceled and the drill was called off. Well, the men were thrilled. They had the weekend to themselves. He picked up his two canvas bags, loaded the back of his car, said he practically ran every red light, broke every speeding sign that there was to get home. Pulled into the driveway, didn't think a thing about all the lights being off. Opened the trunk, pulled out both canvas bags, and walked around the house and through the little black sliding doors in the back. Made his way in and around the little breakfast table and down the hall. And he said, that's when I heard it, the laughter. It was the far bedroom on the right. I opened the door and I found my wife with another man. I threw on the lights. I dropped the canvas bags. I was visibly shaking, he said. I slammed the door, went through the house, turning on all of the lights. Went back down the hall, opened the door to the closet. I pulled out my 12-gauge shotgun. I put 5 bullets in, and I went back to the little breakfast table and I sat down and I took the safety off the gun And I waited. 5-10 minutes of silence. And then here came a man down the hall. And just as he rounded the corner to face me, I pumped the shotgun. I put it to my shoulder and I pointed it right at his face. He said, "I can't tell you why I didn't squeeze that trigger. Only God knows. I would have ruined my life, but I didn't." I said, "Get out of here." I never slept in my bed again. I divorced that woman. But he says with Christian conviction, "I kept my word. I raised that little girl and I educated her till she was 21. You see her argument? He's long gone. Out of sight, out of mind. I want you to see something else that reinforces her argument, and it is not to be missed. You see, this woman never tries to convince him for one moment that adultery is right. Never. Only that he can get away with it. You see that? That's the force of her argument. Out of sight, out of mind, you can get away with it. Now that takes us back to that important verb of verse 6. To look down. To look out is to look down. But you know, in the examples that I gave you, it was men looking down. But here's some other uses of that verb, to look down. Psalm 14:2, the Lord looks down from heaven. Psalm 33:13, from heaven the Lord looks down and sees. Psalm 53 and verse 2, God looks down. And Lamentations 3:50, the Lord looked down from heaven and saw. You say, he doesn't see? He sees everything. How do you teach your children? In our society today, they're gone from us so fast. And then they're out and they're with the crowd. Well, this is how you teach them, and this is what you say. Your father, your mother, they might not be with you. They don't see where you go, who you talk to, or what you do. But you make no mistake about it. The Lord God sees everything. He sees it all. And he knows it all. That's the way you teach them. That's the way you train them. Your children, your grandchildren, on and on and on. If you can't be honest to me in my presence, how are you ever going to learn to be honest with the Lord? Who you can't see, who is not in your presence. That's the way you teach them. That's the way you train them. The invisible God is with us, among us, closer than our skin. That's training your children. Next time, we'll go through the interpretation. That's where the parents take the narrative and begin to tell the story from their own voices. No longer the power of observation, but now the power of interpretation. And specifically, I want to tell you how I took my son through this passage. Let's bow before the Lord of the Word. Thank you, Father, for this instruction this morning. Bless us and help us. We're so weak. We're so pitiful. Our testimonies are so frail, but by your marvelous grace, you give us power, power from you, power from your Spirit,
power from your word to be bold, to be confident, to teach, to train, and to know the scriptures and the power of the scriptures, that they change our lives. Make us the people you want us to be, an honoring, God-fearing people, because you see it all. Nothing, nothing is hidden from your sight. Bless us to that end. In Jesus' name, amen.